Welcome to Worldview from WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonald. Spain had a big terrorist attack in 2004, then the attack in Barcelona last week. We'll discuss whether Spain had good policing or good luck. Also, we'll call Hong Kong and talk about the threat to rule of law after the sentencing of three pro-democracy advocates. And on Global Notes, Tony Sarabia dissects the World Music Festival's all-night-long Ragamala celebration. Don't forget, you can join the conversation on Twitter at WBEZ Worldview. It certainly sounds like the attacks in Spain could have been worse. The Guardian quotes police as saying the terror cell that killed 15 people and injured more than 130 in northeast Spain last week created a suicide vest packed with viable explosives and were in the process of making several more when a blast ripped through their bomb factory. On the other hand, there's been some soul-searching that things could have been better. The Reuters news agency says an opportunity to uncover the plot may have been missed as a result of procedural errors and a lack of communication. Krishnadev Kalamore is a senior editor at The Atlantic, and he thought things through in a piece called How Did Spain Avoid Terrorism Before Barcelona? Krishnadev, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
Spain, on the whole, while the rest of Europe suffered some pretty big terrorist attacks between 2004 and last week, Spain didn't. It looks like a pretty good track record.
Yeah, that's right. Spain's counterterrorism strategy was adopted after the attacks in 2004 on Madrid's commuter rail system. That attack killed about 170 people. And over the next 13 years, Spain adopted a pretty aggressive counterterrorism posture. It arrested 700 people, convicted dozens of others. And it also imprisoned like 100 people for terrorism-related offenses and foiled several plots. And while during those years, cities like London, Paris, and Brussels were in the headlines for many, many attacks, Spain almost seemed immune from these until the attack in Barcelona.
Why do you think Spain took this aggressive edge? I mean, if it sounds like they took a pretty aggressive edge, is this because of their past experience with terrorism in the Basque region? And did they have kind of an attitude about it, do you think?
That's definitely possible. I think a lot of European countries have historically suffered from terrorism. Obviously, you had the IRA in the UK and ETA, that's the Basque separatist movement in Spain, which through the 1970s and before that, and even through the 80s, had attacks on a fairly large scale. But they weren't deadly in the way the modern attacks have been. However, having said that, Spain has had a record of dealing with these militant groups. And I think when the Madrid attack took place in 2004, they knew what to do. And they took the same aggressive posture they took against previous groups.
And the counterterrorism force in Spain sounds like it is substantially large enough to do the job. They devoted a lot of people to it.
El País, the Spanish newspaper, did a story in June, in fact, heralding how great their service was. It said there were, I think, more than 3,000 officers that called it a silent army were working to prevent another attack. They had placed thousands of people under surveillance, tapped phones, looked at mosques, and the newspaper also added, and this is the interesting part, that even though Spain had amassed such a large force, authorities were pretty convinced that another attack was inevitable.
Why did they come to that conclusion? Everyone, I guess, you know, everybody's vulnerable to attack, but if you're really cracking down and doing a good job, you would think you would kind of brag a little about the results.
I think they did brag a little bit about the results, which is probably why they had the kind of coverage they did. But having said that, it's counterterrorism is probably a very, very hard job. You need to just fail once, and it doesn't really matter how many plots you foiled over the previous 13 years. And it's really virtually impossible these days to stop someone who's truly intent on attacking civilians, especially if that person is using a low-tech weapon like a van, as we saw in Barcelona. And what made that super interesting was the fact that they had planned a much wider scale, larger scale attack with bombs and suicide vests, but because their bomb factory exploded, they had to rely on a so-called low-tech vehicular attack, which is becoming increasingly popular in Europe among militants. And if someone wants to do that, it's virtually impossible unless you're able to read into someone's mind that they are going to do this.
I'm talking with Krishnadev Kalamore. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic. His recent piece is How Did Spain Avoid Terrorism Before Barcelona? The scope of the attack, you were mentioning there the vests, the bomb factory, the car, there were a lot of people involved in this attack. That's got to give people some pause. And the van driver was a Moroccan-born man. Morocco's such an easy back and forth for Spain. It's got to give people pause about the dimensions of the attack and the proximity. It's got to be anxiety creating.
I'm sure it is. The interesting thing is Morocco, the Spanish authorities have actually praised Morocco over the last decade or so for a very, very strong counterterrorism strategy and cooperation with Spanish authorities. Obviously, Morocco, which is the kingdom, has been dealing with these sorts of issues for a very long time as well, and they have been pretty brutal at cracking down on militant groups. But, as I said earlier, you're only as good as the last attack you stopped, and it's virtually impossible, as you point out, that people can ferry back and forth, and the one person whom you miss is the one who carries it out. Now, in this particular case, there was this imam who had been on their radar for 13 years. In fact, he had contacts with the folks who carried out contacts with the folks who carried out the 2004 attack in Madrid, and he had been under their radar, but apparently he had managed to recruit these people, and he's the guy who died in the bomb factory explosion. And despite his deaths, he had made enough of an impact on these young men that they decided they would go ahead and carry out their attacks.
The imam. It sounds like the recruitment of people in Spain, it hasn't been as large as in other places, that people aren't going to fight in Syria or somewhere else because I'm not sure what, but Spain didn't have as many recruits apparently. And if you don't have as many recruits, you don't have as many recruits coming home, I guess.
Right. This is exactly right. But compared to other European countries, Spain hasn't had as many people go to places like Syria and Iraq to fight on the side of ISIS. One reason for that, people say, is because Spain has better integrated its immigrant communities. Having said that, Spain also has a very long record of people fighting in Chechnya, Bosnia, the conflicts of those conflicts, the early conflicts of the early part of this century, and Salafist movement. And obviously, let me preface this by saying, obviously, not all Salafists are militants, but the Salafist movements have been fairly active along the Spanish coast for a very long time, and authorities have been aware of this. They've been aware of people going back and forth. I don't personally know, and I don't think it's been announced yet, whether the folks who carried out this attack were in fact linked to ISIS, had actually traveled to Syria or Iraq to be trained. But there has been a history of people going back and forth and people returning to Spain after fighting in other conflicts.
There's kind of an interesting situation in Barcelona where in a couple of months they're going to be voting on an independence referendum that's not recognized by the Spanish government. But there's been a lot of back and forth about how the terrorist attack affects that Catalan independence movement. Do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, it just seems like a wild card, but
Obviously, there's a very strong pro-secessionist movement in Catalonia. They've had these non-binding type votes before, and they've passed. Obviously, the Spanish government has said this time also that they will not recognize any result, and in fact thinks that the vote is invalid. Having said that, I think if anything, Spanish authorities, the post-attack, the post-attack strategy of the Spanish government is likely to maybe, hopefully, in their view, persuade Catalonians that it is in their best interest to remain part of Spain, because these are the kinds of kinds of security problems that are best solved together. Having said that, militancy of the kind we're seeing now is a relatively modern phenomenon, whereas Catalonian secessionist movement and secessionist movements the world over aren't. They've been going on for a very long time.
Yeah, I have read some of the Catalonian independence people saying our policing was so great, it means we can be independent, and this just bolsters our case for independence. But the king shows up, and the prime minister and everything. You know, I imagine it can go either. I think it looks like a toss up, and probably economic issues are going to decide this more than anything else.
Right.
Where does Spain go from here on its counterterrorism experience? Does it? Do you think they'll end up devoting more resources, getting more uptight about Morocco? Where does it end up?
I mean, I think with the Morocco question, I think Spain sees Morocco as a very reliable partner. This is not a case of the U.S. dealing with Pakistan. It's Morocco has recognized a very long time ago that this is a serious problem, and it's cracked down. And if you notice, it's one of the places in the Arab world that was relatively unaffected by the Arab Spring. The monarchy still exists. The human rights groups have criticized them for the way they've dealt with a lot of militancy, but they've cracked down. So I don't think security cooperation with Morocco is actually a problem. The issue is what happens within Spain and within Europe. Europe has obviously open borders, and you know, I think one of the people who was involved in the attack previously lived in France. These are more of issues. European security coordination is more likely to be an issue because, as we know, there are so many different agencies and they don't all necessarily share information the right way or in a coordinated way. Those are the areas where you're going to have more focus and tightening than the arrangement they have with Morocco right now.
Krishnadev Kalamore is a senior editor at The Atlantic. He wrote the piece, How Did Spain Avoid Terrorism Before Barcelona? Thanks a lot for joining us again and talking about the situation there with Spain.
You're welcome.
Pro-democracy activists were in the streets again in Hong Kong over the weekend. We'll call Hong Kong after the break and talk about the crackdown on the rule of law. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. Hong Kong's pro-democracy umbrella movement brought people out into the streets for 79 days in 2014. The Chinese authorities are still cracking down. There's a lot on the list when you add it up. There was the abduction of booksellers by Beijing. They abducted Hong Kong booksellers who were selling the wrong kind of books. There was the oath-taking disqualification of pro-democracy legislators pretty recently. And in June, there was a big military parade and a stern lecture from Xi Jinping during the 20th anniversary of the British handover to China of Hong Kong. And now we've got prison sentences for several umbrella movement leaders that they also disqualify them from running for public office for 5 years. And with us on the line to talk about where things are is Michael Dagovis. He's been a professor of law in Hong Kong for 30 years. He's now a senior fellow at the University of Hong Kong. And he's also a professor of law at the School for International Affairs at Jindal Global University in India. Thanks for joining us, Michael Dagovis.
You're welcome.
You know, I recited some of the instances and things that are happening in Hong Kong, because when you add it up, there is a lot of pressure on the pro-democracy people, and it just seems to be increasing and getting worse. Where does that get things?
Yeah, what I think is happening, and this starts in June of 2014, when Beijing issues a white paper where they essentially say that all the benefits that Hong Kong has comes from Beijing, and Beijing can pretty much take them away as it wants. For Hong Kong people, this was an eye-opener because they understood their situation was set up under the Sino-British Treaty, which guaranteed Hong Kong that it would be an open society and have the rule of law for 50 years. The rule of law is very important in Hong Kong, probably the most important core value. What we've been seeing since then, apparently Beijing is nervous about having political opposition in Hong Kong, so it has interfered in Hong Kong more and more. You described several of the kinds of things, and there's a general sense that the Hong Kong government now in power, which was essentially chosen by Beijing. The chief executive is chosen by a committee that pretty much is made up of pro-Beijing figures, that this government is beholden to Beijing and sort of doing Beijing's bidding to control Hong Kong. I think that's the fear in Hong Kong. And so the Hong Kong really lacking, it's supposed to be an autonomous region, but it lacks an autonomous government that will defend its autonomy. And so historically, all the protests over many years, sometimes as many as 500,000 protesters on the streets, really reflect civil society taking on itself the role of guarding Hong Kong's autonomy. That's what we're seeing now. We're seeing blowback as Beijing interferes more and more. We're seeing more and more a willingness of civil society to speak up. The umbrella movement you mentioned being very big on that.
And the umbrella movement's main point during those 79 days of street protests in 2014 was about the right to vote for the leader of Hong Kong. They wanted universal suffrage and to be able to vote for the leader of Hong Kong. And they didn't get that. And now it seems like there's, I'm surprised at the number of people who want outright independence now, especially among young people in Hong Kong. I was reading some polls, and one from a year ago showed that 17% of citizens would back splitting from China, and 40% of 15 to 24-year-olds. That's an awful lot.
Yeah, I think what you see, and I think this is not always coming through clearly in the media, is when Hong Kong people want democracy, you'd have to ask, well, why do they want democracy? They never had it really under the British. And I think the answer is the popular view is that democracy would enable them to have a government that would defend Hong Kong's autonomy, and most importantly, with that, the rule of law. So you can look at the umbrella movement on the one hand as pushing for direct election of the chief executive and the legislative council, but also on the other as an expression of concern that the Beijing's interference is going to diminish the rule of law. And it very much did in that case, because Beijing took such liberties with the promise of universal suffrage that the universal suffrage they offered would be unrecognizable to anyone anywhere else, maybe the kind they have in Cuba where everybody has to vote, but don't really have a choice of candidates. So I think that democracy gets entangled in Hong Kong's core values. And a lot of young people have seen this, you know, marching and protesting for many years, and yet they still don't have their democracy. And I think after the umbrella movement, some of them sort of took another step and says, well, we should have independence. And I think the calculus is, well, you know, since we can't get democracy when we ask for it under the basic law, then we should ask for independence, take a more radical view. Let's put it this way. I think that if Beijing actually fulfilled its commitment of democracy in Hong Kong, which is in the Basic Law, then I think a lot of the more radical positions would quiet down. At the end of the day, Hong Kong people want to preserve their society.
I wonder if we could talk more specifically about rule of law for a second. I noticed one of the judges in the sentencing of the Three Umbrella Movement leaders, he used some verbiage that I don't equate with rule of law. He was talking about how that he wanted to provide a deterrent with his sentencing to what he called the sick trend of anti-government protest. Such arrogant and self-righteous thinking has unfortunately affected some young people and led them to damage public order and peace during protests. That's pretty heavy stuff coming from the defender of the rule of law in Hong Kong.
Generally, I think the courts are well regarded in Hong Kong. They're highly respected. There's three branches of government, as there is in the United States, the executive, legislative, and the courts. And the executive, legislative have been controlled by Beijing throughout the 20 years since the handover. They set up the minimum elections that occur for the legislature to ensure a pro-government majority. And the government itself, of course, is selected by the Beijing Committee. So I think people here respect the courts. And what I think they're seeing is that the government now is using the courts to go after its political opponents. Now, judges are people too. So some judges are going to be moderate, some are going to be conservative, just as we see in the U.S. Supreme Court. And obviously this judge, the language he's using shows someone who's probably more on the conservative, more considerate of the pro-government concerns. But at the end of the day, I think the party that most people blame, and I was on the street the other night when about 50,000 people were marching opposing these sentences of these young activists, I think they really point their finger at the government. Why is the government going back to court on appeal and trying to have harsh sentences of young people who really seem to represent what most Hong Kong people want, which is genuine autonomy for Hong Kong and Hong Kong people ruling Hong Kong? So getting the court mixed up in it, I think, for the government is going to backfire. So far, I think the court's reputation is reasonably good. But I think by doing this, the government puts that third branch of government at risk as well in terms of public reputation. And one would hope they don't go down this path too far. But so far, they seem intent on doing so.
I'm talking with Michael Davis. He's been a law professor in Hong Kong for the last 30 years, and we're talking about what's happened in Hong Kong with the Umbrella Movement leaders who were recently sentenced to prison terms that would also disqualify them from holding public office in the future. And there were big protests on Sunday evening. And what was it like at the protests, 50,000 people in the streets? What is that like?
Well, I've been in many protests. I was a member of the Article 23 Concern Group when we had half a million protesters in the street. But what I found was interesting about this episode was the youth of the protesters. So really, a lot of young people have been put off greatly by seeing other youngsters. You know, Joshua Wong, he's viewed as the face of democracy here in Hong Kong, and he's only 20 years old, couldn't even run for the Legislative Council in last year's election because of his age. And now with his sentence, if it's not reversed on appeal, he won't be able to run for office for 5 years because along with a punishment, a prison term of more than 3 months comes a barring of the person from running for the Legislative Council or any political office. So I think the young people I saw were very passionate the other day, and it was quite a dense situation. Where you march in Hong Kong is usually a narrow strip along a street from one section of the city to the other, and it was backed up for several hours just getting people through the zone that the government allowed them to march in. So I think it was quite a surprising response to, you know, on a very short notice for this particular protest.
We've been talking about the branches of government, but with young people being so prominent in the protest movement. Is the education system a big target in Hong Kong? Is there moves by Beijing to, lay a little more verbiage on students?
That's exactly right. And what happened, really the first big protest after the handover was the Article 23 protest. These were protests a decade ago when the government was trying to enact national security and subversion and secrecy, sedition and so on laws. And they seemed to be, the drafts they had were very threatening to free speech in Hong Kong. And 500,000 protesters took to the street. I think this was 2003, and I think that's when Beijing sort of got the idea, wait a minute, maybe the Hong Kong youth need to be educated better on what China is and so on. And so by 2012, the government was putting forward these education guidelines that was to provide national education for Hong Kong. But the language that was used in a booklet that was produced was really brainwashing. And a lot of the young people that have now been put in jail and were on the streets first got their sort of political wheels in those 2012 protest over national education. But both the Article 23 and the national education stuff was withdrawn by the government. But what we see now are threats to bring it back. And Beijing officials seem particularly keen on promoting the idea that these national security and sedition laws should be enacted and that young people in Hong Kong should be re-educated as to China's history.
I think a lot of people who are observing this from outside, see these young people fighting for basic ideas that we believe are good and really are the basis for having a healthy society. But it seems unclear what outsiders should do about it. It seems like the Chinese brush off the British pretty easily. The United States does not seem to be interested in democracy promotion, really, under President Trump. He made a speech just the other day where he talked about we're not going to really push democracy on people or anything. We're just going to go with interests here. So it's unclear how much influence the U.S. really has on Hong Kong. What should outsiders do about this thing?
Well, one thing is the outsider yourself, as the media, that what you're doing now is really important because it informs the public, in the United States, what's happening. Another thing that's important, I spent the last year as a senior fellow at the National Endowment for Democracy in Washington, and I met with people in a lot of these organizations that the U.S. has in place to promote democracy. And under the Trump administration, the funding for these organizations, even USAID, which does a lot of work also in promoting these kinds of issues, has been threatened with being cut and so on. And I think so the average American certainly can encourage their congressman. And the general view, I think, among the think tanks that do this kind of work is that Congress has historically been supportive, both Republicans and Democrats. So I think those are some things that can be done. And otherwise, I suppose just keeping up on the issues, if they have organizations, like if they're members of bar associations, for example, where the concern might be with civil liberties, again, the Chicago Bar or local branch of Amnesty International and so on, those organizations can write reports and try to do things. It's not totally hopeless, but it is true that the bigger steps are on the ground in the community here. But part of how protests work for these kinds of issues is that you try to persuade local people to support your cause, but also to inform the international community so that there is a kind of ethical pressure on Beijing. Beijing may not respond to direct government criticisms, but it does notice if its popularity goes down as a result of draconian steps that it's taking in Hong Kong. And I think it is important to inform the public on these issues.
Michael Davis has been a professor of law in Hong Kong for 30 years. He's now a senior fellow at the University of Hong Kong, and he's also now a professor of law at the School of International Affairs at the Jindal Global University in India. Thanks for joining us and talking about the situation in Hong Kong.
You're welcome.
Well, public buildings don't often stay up all night long for parties, but the Cultural Center is going to do that for World Music Festival Chicago, and we're going to talk about the Indian Music Festival there after the break. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You're listening to Worldview on WBEZ. This is Worldview on WBEZ. I'm Jerome McDonnell. It's time for Global Notes, our look at international music. And with me is Tony Sarabia, the host of Morning Shift and Radio M, and we are going to chat about one of the seminal events in international music in our fine city.
Yeah, it's the World Music Festival Chicago 2017, but instead of this year going over the whole schedule, because it's quite extensive, you can go online or maybe Worldview tweeted it out. We're going to focus on the opening night, and boy, what a night it is. I've never done this, so I think I'm going to do it this year.
I've never done it either. I've never showed up for Ragamala, and it's you get to go to the Cultural Center all night long and listen to Indian music.
6:30 p.m. on Friday, September 8th. That's the first day of the festival, and it runs through 10 a.m. the next morning. Part of that is, Jerome, you can head over to Millennium Park for some music and yoga at sunrise on Saturday morning.
It's gong meditation and yoga. So
yeah.
that would be a great way to end your all-night event at the Cultural Center. I would be so tired I'd probably fall asleep during gong meditation. But
they used to do this at the end of the festival, and for a couple of years now they moved it to the front of the festival.
And when you're filling up an entire night of music, there you have to have a lineup. And when we're looking at it, we could break that down, and that would be a segment in itself. And so that's what we're doing.
We're going to
break down the whole evening.
First, the word Ragamala, it's the title of a composition of 12 verses running into 60 lines that names various ragas. And it literally means – Ragamala means a garland of ragas or musical melodies. Mala means garland. And of course, raga is a musical composition or mode, which has also given rise to a series of ragamala paintings. And it's interesting. I wonder if the painter is painting while they're playing music. Wouldn't that be cool?
Oh, yeah. Live. That would be multitasking.
Yeah. So they're not doing that part of the ragamala, but there will be a lot of dancing. Kalapriya Dance Company here in Chicago has a big role in this. A lot of this is Hindustani music, Carnatic music, more on the, I don't know if you'd call it mellow, as opposed to Bhangra and Bollywood, of course, but it certainly is beautiful music, lots of strings and a lot of percussion.
Well, let's hear some of it. Who's the first artist on the list here?
Well, this is a trio, and what a trio it is. It consists of violin, vocals, the vocals Shiv Srabamaniam and young violinist Shruti Sarathi. The percussionist plays a mridingam, and that's it's kind of a long drum, two-headed drum, two
it
sides to the drum.
It looks like a conga with two sides.
Yeah, you sit down and you play it, or I guess if you have a strap, you can stand up. This is one of the very few women artists who plays this instrument. She started playing when she was 5 years old. Her dad played this instrument. Her mom since passed away. She was a singer, so she grew up in a musical family. She used to get really frustrated because her hands were too small and they weren't strong enough to play this drum. So what her parents did is they gave her piano lessons to strengthen her hands. And since then, she's been touring all over the world. She plays this instrument not only in traditional Carnatic music, but in jazz. I think for most of this, it'll be Carnatic music. But here's some of her work doing. It's just solo. Thank you.
We're listening to some of the music from the kickoff to the World Music Festival. It's the Ragamala at the Cultural Center. They go all night long with music. And that was Sruti Sarati, and she's a percussionist, and she'll be performing in a trio that is looks like they're going to play at 7:50 and then again at 3:25 a.m. Holy
I know.
Smokes. Yeah. She'll be tired.
Actually, that was Rajna Swaminathan. She's the percussionist.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Sruti will be accompanying her on violin, and then there'll be a vocalist. That'll be some pretty hypnotic stuff. You know, she's played, by the way, with a dulcimer player who's got roots here in Evanston. He goes by Mag ZT. I don't know if he's been on this program, but I did a story on him years ago when he was just like 12 or 13. He just picked up the hammered dulcimer, and now he travels all over the world playing all kinds of music with artists like the artists that we just heard.
Well, that'll be super fun, and it's fun to see a percussionist of that quality. Now, the next person we're hearing is a pianist.
Vocalist, Anjali Ray. She is it's hard to describe her. She mixes pop music but also incorporates some Hindustani traditions, and from what I understand, that's what she'll be doing when she plays. This is going to be 6:30 to 7:30. This was a woman who spends time in Chicago and L.A. She was born in New Delhi, but she moved here to the U.S. when she was about 10 years old. This is the title track from her album, which, by the way, someone from Indie Music Reviews said, the Indian factor makes this one all it can be. He goes on to say, and I love this, I can imagine a bonfire burning with Indian drummers sitting around in a circle with Anjali singing in the round. It's a masterstroke, simply mind-blowing in every way.
That's a good review.
Right? So this is the title track from her album.
That's Anjali Ray, and she will be performing at Ragamala at the catchable hour of 6:30 p.m., 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Cultural Center, and that's coming up here at the World Music Festival, the opening night, and her program is going to have to do with Bollywood
films. This is going to be really cool, Jerome, because it's just going to be her, a tabla player, and a harmonium player. So really, really stripped down. That'll be really interesting and kind of cool to hear. She's got a beautiful voice.
Very nice. Let's move along and hear some other artist from this fine event.
Well, how about Alam Kham? He is someone who plays an instrument. It's a 25-stringed fretless instrument called the sarod. Gorgeous sound. He's the son of the legendary Ali Akbar Khan, who not only popularized this instrument, but also belongs in the same class as Ravi Shankar. I mean, when it comes to this instrument, that's how big he is. His son plays all kinds of music with the sarod. I mean, he's played with Bob Weir of the Grateful Dead. He's played with the Tedeschi Trucks Band. And he's teaming up with Ambi Subramaniam. Remember we had him in with his son? Yeah, they were fantastic. So this is probably going to be a little, infusing Hindustani sounds with a more contemporary approach.
That is exactly the kind of music I want to hear at about midnight on Friday, September 8th, when they are at the Cultural Center, Alam Khan there. That's great.
People who experience the whole thing from 6:30 to 10 a.m., Jerome, they are going to have the best Saturday of their whole life after experience. I mean, this music, it's just so...
Better they'll be tired.
It's just so calming and relaxing, puts you in such a, I don't know, positive vibe, right? So they're going to... It'll be Alam Khan on the sarod. The tabla player is Salah Nadir. He is... He was born in Germany to Afghan parents, and he, like the other two musicians, has really branched out. I mean, he's played with Bella Fleck, Herbie Hancock. He's dabbled in jazz fusion, electronic music. He regularly works with the Kornos Quartet as well, and he's done some film music. You know, the tabla player is the guy who composed the music for The Kite Runner.
The resume of some of these people is amazing. When you get into the global music thing, you can really have an interesting career and play lots of different music.
Well, it seems pretty specific, or more so with Indian musicians, right? They just take this foundation and then they just run with it, because everybody wants to play this kind of music, right?
Absolutely. We're talking about Ragamala at the World Music Festival. It's their opening gig Friday night, all night long at the Cultural Center. Let's hear from somebody else.
How about some more sitar music? This is Rupa Panasir. He's a British sitar player, and he sort of represents, you know, I think there's only been one artist who was born in India, but even so, she moved from India when she was 10. A lot of these players are part of the diaspora, the wide diaspora, and this player is no exception. He plays sitar. What more can you say? The sitar is a great instrument.
That's Rupa Panasar, and she'll be playing sitar at 5 a.m. at the Cultural Center on, I guess that would be Saturday, September 9th, really early in the morning, or late, late, late Friday night if you're there all night.
Great breakfast music. And again, this is another artist room. A lot of these artists are young, and a lot of these artists expand their musical...
Can stay alert all night.
Expand their musical vocabulary. She's done some work with Talvin Singh, pretty influential electronic musician. She's worked with a Spanish composer and also Western classical music, but she loves Hindustani music the most, and that's probably what we're going to hear most of during this set.
Should we try to slip in one more artist before we go?
How about another vocalist? This is Aditya Prakash, an American-born singer, and again, deep roots in Carnatic music.
Gori tore ne na Gori tore ne na Kajara bin kare Gori tore
And that's Aditya Prakash, and they're performing on Friday night at the tolerable hour of 10:45 to 11:45.
Brother and sister.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah, so he'll be singing and she'll be dancing.
That's Friday, September 8th at the World Music Festival opening night at the Chicago Cultural Center, Ragamala. It's Indian music all night long.
And I think there will be Indian food. I think there has been in the past.
They've got to feed you.
Or just bring your
there
own,
all night.
Bring your own little picnic basket.
And then you get yoga and gong meditation in Millennium Park at 8 a.m.
Yes.
So this could be a kind of personal breakthrough for the whole Chicago area if we showed up there. Thanks a lot for joining us, Tony Sarabia, for another fine edition of Global Notes. We'll talk about the rest of the World Music Festival again soon.
All righty.
Tomorrow on Worldview, we'll meet a conservationist from Shanghai who's in town to learn a bit about how we do trees here. Hope you can join us tomorrow for Worldview. You can always subscribe to the Worldview podcast and listen to it at any time. You can go to iTunes, Google Play, wherever you get your podcasts. We're at WBEZ Worldview. Or you could go to wbez.org/worldview and subscribe there as well. Worldview is produced by Steve Bynum and Julian Haida. I'm Jerome McDonnell. You've been listening to Worldview on WBEZ.